There's some slides that are hidden if we get into more detail, and somehow this one pulled forward. Scott, just keep going. Yeah. Go ahead, Scott. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. The questions I had them at the end here. We've sort of gotten into a few of them right there. So we're really, that's where we are. That's where we are now. We've already talked about the vegetation. Next one, then. We've weighed in on the user survey. Excuse me for just a second. Next one, Scott. And I think this is where, if the commissioning, the question we listed out there. Oh, I'm sorry. Could you go back to three, Scott? That was my fault. Okay, this is a two-part, and I think this is where this also starts to be in a more broad brush way where your points are in there. Based on the user information and visual impact information, as a whole, do the impacts on the significant resources create an unreasonable adverse impact effect on scenic character and daytime use related to scenic character? And we're going to have to start getting... Down to that. If commissioners include visual impact analysis, scenic impacts associated with the views of the project from Tonk Mountain, as we discussed. As a whole, does that change your answer with respect to question three? We brought up the Tonk. Portions are in, portions are out. It might be a good time to even though it's question four, if there's any concerns about that, it might be worth looking at that.
The only thing is, area that is not available to the public, okay, if it's private and there is no, like, Great Ponds, that we know that they're available to the public, irrespective of ownership. Tonk Mountain, if there are areas that are not available to the public, they're privately owned, not available to the public, then they're beyond our analysis. I think that's fairly clear to all of us. So it isn't, that isn't, to me, isn't the issue. Okay? Again, it's just a question of if the number of users were not taken into account with the analysis change. Maybe you ask me, I don't know. That would be up to, I think, our consultant and Mr. DeWan, and then we could, or whomever, and we could make a decision. But I mean, I think that the open question is not. The question is still, are we using number of users or aren't we? And that's not.
I think the only reason we highlight this issue of ownership of Tonk is because originally in the application, it was identified as a coastal scenic resource. And in pursuing that further with SPO, we've understood that it's not eligible. So then that leaves the question of whether the remainder of the mountain comes in under some other criterion, and our understanding it does not. However, there are portions of the summit that are within the BPL boundary. A large portion of the trails are not, but we just wanted to make sure you were aware of which portions and how much visibility there are for the portions that are jurisdictional. And I think looking at the viewshed maps at least helped me a lot understand where the impacts are within the Donnell Pond unit, because they are in very particular places as opposed to being widespread. And there are a few clearings up there that appear, to the best of our ability to understand, given mapping error and everything else, there appear to be a few clearings on Tonk that are jurisdictional where you can see the turbines. I think that your question is right on about, you know, it's a backcountry area, it's used as such, there's not a lot of people up there, you know, in what way should we consider that?
Exactly.
And, you know, the Wind Energy Act says to take into account use, extent, nature, duration, but, you know, there may be some resources that are so valuable that low use is not necessarily an impediment to protecting them. So I think that's exactly right. But the reason we highlighted it was to clarify any jurisdictional issues.
But isn't it, I mean, just so I'm clear, We deal with scenic resources of statewide and national significance within 8 months. The Donnell Management Unit is an area of statewide significance. Those portions, and only those portions of Tunk or Black Mountain that fall within that unit, are subject to the analysis.
Right.
And then, because they're publicly accessible and they're in an area of statewide significance.
Right.
How many people use them is the question about how should that be assessed? And maybe it'll have no impact whatsoever. Might have an impact, might not.
Correct. So the whether they can be considered or not considered is exactly as you described. Is it
right.
Does it qualify? And then, but then, what do you do with that after? Right. What kind of judgment do you make? That gets into that gets into your question about use.
The only thing I have to say is because it was on the slide is, I have a slight problem with this notion of preferred view. You know, whose preferred view? I mean.
I just
think that muddies the water slightly. That's all.
That's certainly something advanced by the applicant. I believe I'd have to look back, but I believe that came through in the surveys. So we could all go through those questions if that's helpful. I think reasonable people can take two different views
exactly.
About that.
That's all I'm saying. Mm-hmm.
If you follow the results of the survey, which assumes that 15 to 17% may not come back, does that reduce the impact on the Great Pond?
Exactly. You'll be talking resource or people.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
And I know we're getting back into that discussion, but it's important to know the template that the wildland lakes what was used. And whether any of that has been changed and for what
exactly.
Reason. So just a way to do our homework, is it remote? Is it publicly accessible but remote? That's an oxymoron almost. But
yeah.
is that what determined it? Or is it publicly accessible and nobody uses it? Is that a factor? So I won't go any further than that. But fewer people using the resource because they don't like wind farms could be less impact on the water itself, as long as the water doesn't react to the wind farm. You know what I mean? I mean, that's
the asphalt.
Yeah.
There's Glenn. Glenn? Glenn?
I'm sorry.
Yes, Samantha.
I also just want to mention that this could be, you can hearken back to the Plum Creek decision, too, because there was a determination for a pond. I have the materials with me. I'd have to look at it for which one. That one of the lakes was accessible and undeveloped and provided a remote recreation experience. And for that reason was very highly valued. So in that case, at least, accessibility wasn't the trigger for protection. It was the remote recreation, primitive recreation experience, and the sense of remoteness from the pond. So that's just it's a past thought process that you've gone through.
I think this whole thing is very complicated because, just because it's... the number of people that are at a place is some indication of how valuable it is to people. Whether it's, there are remote ponds that many people would not view as all that attractive or a place to spend time. Whether they're, access certainly is part of that whole thing. But there are other remote ponds that are very attractive places to be. So I don't, and I'm not sure to what extent the wildlands, I almost want to go back and read some of the information in the wildlands assessment now that we've had this discussion. And I don't know whether anybody else feels the same way, but it might be good if we allowed ourselves that time to do that.
I have two thoughts. One is I'd very much like to go back and read that and consider it. The other thing is if we look at Mount Katahdin and the value of Mount Katahdin based on the number of people who have climbed it, you would have a tiny percentage of people who place a very high value on that mountain for its scenic and cultural significance, and a fraction of the people of the population, even of Millinocket, have climbed it. So I'm not sure. I think it's sort of analogous. I think it has to stand on its own value, and I would very much like to go back and look at that language through this prism. Mm. And I would also ask what kind of, if we were to do that, what kind of impact would that have on our timing? I mean, we have a statutory requirement of 270 days or something, right? I mean, where are we in along the road of the ticking clock?
270 is the 270 days would be around October 28th.
Two things. Number one is to look at the management plan in Appendix C, which I spent quite a bit of time the last few days doing. Doesn't really help a lot. What you need is this document that's referenced as the assessment work plan, which provides the logic for the classifications. And again, do you guys know if you have that? Did you get that for Jim?
I'm sorry.
You know what I mean?
We have a document from the mid-'80s that is a documentation of some of the work that did happen going into it. I don't know if it's that specific document, but we did scan that particular one and send it to Jim. If you've already asked, have you asked Fred for it? And no,
but I did. Okay. I did a search for it.
I don't think it's posted anywhere, but I think we can certainly get you what we have, and you can see whether it's the thing you're looking for.
And the second thing I wanted to say is I think we're bound by this time thing, seems to me. So I think we need to do the best we can do. All I'm saying is that right now, today, I don't have enough information to know which way to go. But I think that we could, you know, through the decision document, perhaps have more specific information, and then we're just going to have to make, as Amy suggests, we're going to have to make the judgment when the time comes. But I, what I'm saying is I would like to have more information between now and that time, not that we necessarily anticipate delaying this decision. I don't think we can statutorily.
No, and that's why I asked where we were, so that we wouldn't delay the decision or delay the applicant. I mean, it's not fair to anybody to do that, but I did want to know am I 100 miles from the next McDonald's, or is it around the corner?
I'll chime in for a second here. I'm not sure that what you've identified is a record problem here. This document that you've referred to, I'm not familiar with it, and I can talk to Samantha about it. And if it's a component that was relied upon in the club, it seems appropriate that type of document could be taken into the record for this proceeding if the commission thinks that it needs it. That said, more of what I've heard you discuss today is a legal issue. How are you going to interpret the applicable criteria to this set of facts? And I think that you've been, at least, I understand the issue as you framed it, and I think that Samantha and Don do too, but they can correct me if they need more clarification from you. But I think that it's something that the staff can put their minds to and work that up in a document for your consideration. And if through that process staff identifies pieces that they need to take a look at that aren't in the record, then staff can deal with that and consult with me about whether or not that can be done.
Ava, my understanding of the wildlands assessment was it sort of happened in two pieces, that the original assessment, instead of, it was looking at, okay, where is development most suitable? And ultimately, a lot of the lakes that were determined to be, or ponds to be determined to be most suitable for development were the ones that had no development. Because, look, we can build on these. There's no, you know, the shoreline is uncluttered. There won't be as much, as many impacts, that kind of, because it'll be scattered about. And there was, from what I understand, a significant pushback, because the conclusion really flew in the face of the protective notion of preserving the jurisdiction. So what I'm trying to say is the original plan that came forward said, yes, let's develop these remote, pristine little ponds because there's nothing there. That's where you should put development. And the pushback was, no. We need to, those are the ones that are worthy of protection the most, and we'll develop on places where there currently is development. It's the same idea as like anti-sprawl. And so the ultimate decision and the ultimate intent after the first draft was constructed was just the opposite. Meaning, Ed, I wish you could jump in and say this for me, that ultimately what came about was this notion that, no, we need to preserve and protect those, not develop them, because they are not terribly accessible, because they're not used. They are a specific resource in this state that contributes to the fabric of the jurisdiction that makes Maine what it is. So instead of being designated as the ones most likely to develop, they were the ones you need to protect. And that was the ultimate decision. So those standards that came out reflect the value of those lakes simply because they are not used, because they're not developed. Remoteness or accessibility, I think it was more, was not as much an issue as the character that they held or that they possessed and made them part of the fabric of the jurisdiction.
Go ahead, Samantha.
I think I understand the legal question that you're asking, and I want to do a couple things if you'll indulge me for a minute. One is take you through the Narragansett Lake analysis, because I think I had intended to put some structure around this legal issue in that analysis, and if that hasn't come through, we can certainly elaborate on it. The other thing I want to do, though, is to understand better the specific informational pieces that you still need, because we have accessibility and development ratings, we have scenic ratings, and then Palmer, and I forget whether Dewan did, but at least Palmer went through the original reasons for the ratings and reflected on them in his report, if I recall correctly. Yeah, and so if there's more than that that's needed, then it would be helpful to me to understand, like, did you want the original text of what he was drawing from? Or so that I need a little clarification on that. Would you mind if we went through the Narragansett Lake analysis for a moment? Okay. So in looking at Narragansett Lake, Dewan had relied on the ratings that were in the Wildlands Lake Assessment itself, which was from the late 80s, and what the commission has to use by statute in order to determine which resources are jurisdictional or not. So it specifies the Wildlands Lake Assessment, which is the original document from the late 80s, and if it has scenic or outstanding, significant or outstanding scenic ratings, then that's what triggers the review of that resource. But what happened was that, and I don't know the reasons behind it, I wasn't here at the time, but from the Wildlands Lake Assessment, then to the point when in 1990 the rules were adopted, some of the ratings were changed. And so what we are then working with in Chapter 10 sometimes the accessibility and development ratings are different from what was in the Wildlands Lake Assessment, and so it's a bit of a conundrum sometimes. But what I did in this analysis piece was to use the Chapter 10 ratings for accessibility and development because those are the Commission's current legal standard. So Narragansett Lake, there will be quite a bit of visibility in portions of the lake. It's rated as, it's called relatively inaccessible. In the Chapter 10 itself, it just says INAC, but the full title of that is relatively inaccessible. And it's rated as developed. And the management class is a 7. When there's no class management class rating, it's just automatically a 7. And it received a significant but not outstanding scenic resource rating. So if you take those things into account, is this a resource that, by virtue of its inaccessibility, is special enough to, or by any other standard, special enough to then say, all right, we considered extent, nature, and duration of use, and it's low, but there are other overriding factors why this place deserves special consideration. So the low use in and of itself, does it contribute to the rating, to needing protection, or are there any other reasons why it particularly needs protection? And I think that it's relatively close to settlements. It's not inaccessible because there's a conservation easement, as far as I can tell. Bo Payne's comments indicate that it's industrial forest land around it, and it's just privately owned. So I guess my earlier comments about looking, and then Gwen's as well, about looking at each one, the circumstances of each water body or each resource, and determining if it's got low use, whether that low use is because of or indicates some special nature of that place that really requires heightened protection. That's what I tried to do in this analysis piece. It's one option. I mean, there are many ways to look at this, but I think this is staff putting forward one option for how you could look at this. And if you'd like us to work up other options, we certainly can do that. So that's my overview of this Narragansett Lake piece. And then, so if you can reflect for me on specifically what information you are requesting and analysis you're requesting, we will absolutely do that.
If Jim Palmer, okay, with regard to his assessment of Narragansett Lake, did not take into account the number of users, okay, because here he says he gives it a low, all right, Narragansett Lake is rated as low, tending to medium, due to the low number of users and the lack of public access. If you take those two things out and do the assessment, and the assessment doesn't change, fine. If you take those two things out and the assessment changes dramatically, then it seems, that's what I'd like to hear from him. You see what I mean?
I understand what you're saying.
But you have a problem with it.
No, I'm trying to reflect back so I make sure I understand, because this is your decision, not mine, obviously. And those two things are legal criteria.
Right.
And so what you're trying to do then is to get a better sense of how the other legal criteria, what the specific analysis based on those other legal criteria are separate from the accessibility issue.
Right, exactly.
Okay, all right.
And there's one more thing that Palmer knows about, because he refers to it obliquely in here anyway. The policy question, particularly with regard to Myrick Pond, okay, would the visual impact from this project change its classification? Okay, that's a policy question, mm-hmm. beyond the application of methodology. in order to change the classification, there has to be a modification. There has to be, you can modify one significant or outstanding resource value as long as the other resource values don't change. So even if, you see what I'm saying? That's why I'd like to hear from Jim. If we just said, okay, look, there's seem to be a contradiction here. Let's remove the contradiction by saying, let's not consider, just for the heck of it, number of users, just so we don't run afoul of the Lakes Management Plan, and let's, you know, like double jeopardy. Are the, you know, categories change and the scores, you know, what's going to be the result of that? And if there is no appreciable result, it seems to me that we're on track. If there is an appreciable result, then it seems to me we need to exercise a little, we need to sit down and talk about it during the decisional phase.
I think I understand what you're asking for, and so we can do our best to produce that. I think I would just raise a consideration for how this might apply to other circumstances as well,
yeah.
Which is that this is a development permit application. It's an allowed use. It is based on specific legal criteria as well as the club. And and so if someone were to apply to build a home in an area that had a resource rating that was high, and it was an allowed use, would the commission want staff to potentially deny the building permit based on changes in this? And I'm bringing this up because since 1990, I think a number of lakes and ponds have, their characteristics have changed significantly, and probably some of them no longer qualify in the classifications that they originally did.
Right.
And so it's not to say that we shouldn't consider those changes. I just wanted to also bring up that issue for you to think about.
But those classifications have often changed. That's a whole other discussion. I mean, Bucky Owen would come in here and talk to you all day about this, the significance of this. I don't think, though, that we want to willingly, intentionally modify those classifications. What we need to do is go back and reclassify, not through incremental decisions, knowingly change the classification of these things. So if it rises to the level of changing the classification itself, it seems to me, then it needs some real serious consideration. Okay. I mean, I'm just talking here. I don't know how everybody else feels. I mean, it's just me. And if this isn't an important issue to other people, then fine. But because it's complicated or interrelated, it seems to be kind of dismissed here, and I think it's particularly important. Otherwise, why have the lakes classification scheme at all?
I'm thinking about what to say here. This is The one thing that strikes me is that, and the lakes classification system, I think, was a wonderful system, but it was done in the 80s, has been updated to reflect changes. I think Samantha, in some of your discussion there, you talked about things having changed.
Well,
in a couple of instances.
There was the Wildlands Lake Assessment itself was done in the late 80s, I think maybe 87, something like that. And then... Okay, and then when the Chapter 10 rule was adopted that laid out each of the water bodies in 1990, some of the accessibility and development ratings changed at that point.
That's what I'm referring to.
And so, yeah. But as other than correction of errors, I don't believe there's been any wholesale revision of the ratings in Chapter 10 since 1990. That was considered in the CLUP proceedings. And because one of the things that the commission was considering recommending in the CLUP was to revisit the lakes classifications, we heard from several individuals that, particularly landowners, that they felt that the results of years of discussion and compromise was embodied in those 1990 classifications, including some landowner equity issues, and that to reopen it could be significantly problematic, even though we recognize that some of the ratings have changed. And I believe that in the rule there's a no backsliding provision that says even if the nature of the lake or pond has changed somewhat, the commission is not going to reclassify it in order to then allow, you know, more development just based on the change, that it would always continue in the future to be that same classification. And I think it's designed to prevent, and I don't know this, but I'm assuming that it's designed to prevent people from slowly eroding the character of water body to then be able to put in more and more development, that, you know, what is legally allowed is legally allowed, but then we're not going to make it worse. And that's just for the ones, obviously, that rose to the top, because the majority of them are not in a particular management class. They're just class 7 because they have no rating or no management classification.
So with that gets back to what Ed was just saying about the fact that look at the rating, and would, by doing this, would it devalue that rating or reduce that rating? And it sounds like maybe it's worth taking a look at that, as well as, you know, what Jim Palmer, how he utilized the wildlands assessment in his analysis, which I think you were alluding to earlier.
And to be absolutely clear, you can degrade, like, for example, one of the resource values. It can be degraded and not change the classification.
Right.
So it doesn't mean that you can't, there's no wiggle room.
Exactly.
But in some instances, you can't. And you may recall, I think you were on the commission at the time, we forced a particular a forest operator that they came forward and agreed to do this, was to actually do away with a road that provided access to remote pond.
Remember that?
Mm-hmm. In order to preserve that classification.
Right.
So if there's one instance. I mean, here again, I think we want to just be careful. We're not doing this. And so if we just, I don't think that this, it sounds complicated, but I think the analysis could be relatively straightforward.
Okay.
And when you say change classification, I just want to make sure I understand. So there's resource ratings. There's a resource class, which is 1A, 1B, 2, or 3. And then there's management class, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7. And do you want us to evaluate each of those, or is there one in particular that you're interested in?
All right. First of all, I'm getting repetitious. I would like to see Jim and perhaps Mr. DeWan, I mean, they seem to work pretty well together, say, all right, if we were to take out, just for the sake of discussion, the number of users.
Yeah.
And public access is used in a kind of a funny way here. I mean, any remote pond is public access. I mean, any great pond is public access. They mean ready public access,
right.
I think. But we're talking legal public access.
Right.
And you took out the number of users. Would the assessment change? Okay. If it doesn't, then it seems to me we have there's nothing to be concerned about. The second thing is particularly with regard to Myrick Pond. Palmer says in this document, and it's lifted from his report, it says, in speaking specifically of Myrick Pond, however, if turbine hubs are visible, this may be sufficient to remove the significant scenic quality relating in the main wetlands assessment, main lakes assessment.
Mm-hmm.
If it does that change the classification? If it does, it seems to me there is some, at least a policy question that we need to talk about rather than just sort of gliding over that.
And I'm sorry to be obtuse, but I'm just asking which classification, the resource classification or the management classification?
The management classification.
Okay, thank you. That's all I was asking.
I think this is a valuable exercise because as the altitude of the wind farms decreases, the bodies of water will increase. A lot of great ponds will be in the shadow, so it's time to get it in there. If it may be simple, but should be in there.
Anybody?
Could I just ask Samantha to clarify that the statement that she just made, any decisions that this body may make cannot change the classification of any of these bodies of water. Is that what you just said?
You could go to rulemaking specifically to change the classification of a body of water, but through a decision on a development permit application, that would not in and of itself change the classification. You might create conditions that would change the nature of the water body in such a way that it could be consistent to then change the rating through rule, the classification through rule. You know, you could change the nature of the place in such a way that you could then later go and reclassify it, but the commission has not made a practice of reclassifying water bodies, and that is something that has to be done separately in rule. I'm sorry, was that clear?
Yes, thank you.
I think we're ready to move on to sound.
I just have to say the last question referred to lighting. And
yes.
If you don't mind,
we're
looking for direction
that.
On that.
Oh, and question four also about Tom. But
I think we dealt with that.
Okay.
You have five. It's all right in front of you. I'll read it for those if it's not right queued up. Is the extent, nature, and duration of night use of the scenic resource that have views of the turbine such that users are likely to experience an unreasonable adverse effect as described in the statute in reference to lighting? I wanted to give you the opportunity to have a lighting discussion and analysis. We, as I pointed out earlier, we had the FAA lighting plan, the permit in place. It is permanent lighting. The Met Towers require a light as well. There's that in your
page
40 in your book, 43. Excuse me, 43 in your notebook, section one, you'll see the lighting scheme, and the key shows you right there which ones are lit. The end ones have to be lit, obviously, and then there's a sequence in the string.
I'll might as well weigh in here. In this instance, I do not recall, and I went back to the record, I do not recall major substantial concerns raised with regard to the lighting. That's not to say that we haven't encountered those in other instances with substantial information in the record, but in this instance, I don't recall, and I could be corrected, but I don't recall any substantial testimony in the record directed specifically to the effects of lighting. I stand to be corrected.
What comes to mind is Mr. Michka's on that. And I'm not sure if that was, I have to be honest, I'm not sure if that was at the public hearing. Some of them submitted what they said at the public hearing and then wrote it. I think he wrote an addendum to that, which you have there, and we did refer to that in here. But you would be correct to say this wasn't an overwhelm. It would be fair to say it was not overwhelming in the comments of the public. Overwhelming interest in the comments of the public.
That was my impression as well when I've thought about this. So.
I think generally speaking, I think that we as a commission have an interest in trying to minimize to the extent possible the impact of lighting. And hopefully as new technologies become available and approved by the FAA, they'll be installed. But in this instance, I didn't see, I'll just leave it at that. So there may be other instances where this may become a more important issue.
I think just in thinking about scenic resources in general in this project as compared to some of the other projects that we have reviewed, while there have been issues brought up about it, they have not been to the extent or by the number of people that we have heard from in some of the other projects that we have done. I don't know whether others would have that same impression, but when I just sort of stand back from all of this discussion and think about scenic resources in Bull Hill, that's where I, what I, how I feel about it.